Okay. Gavel's in. Representative Simmons, do you move the A9 amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, so moved, A9 amendments.
Representative Simmons moves the A9 amendments. Discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted. Do you move the bill to the floor?
The floor is to pass recommendation, Mr. Chair.
All right. We have the motion. Is there any objection?
Motion, Mr. Chair.
Motion on 2238. With the A9 amendments. I might call the roll on the motion. Let Representative Olin vote last.
Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Hanson? Oh, sorry.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Mannix votes aye.
Representative Bowman?
Aye.
President Bowman votes aye. Motion's carried. House Bill 2238 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll be the carrier for the bill. That concludes the work session on 2238. Next up is Senate Bill 844. But I don't, is Senator Courtney still coming in? All right, we'll move on to Senate Bill 18. Move us into public hearing on Senate Bill 18. And ask counsel to summarize that measure.
Mr. Chairman, what this bill has to do with is persons on probation. An offender can, of course, have convictions in different counties. For example, we'll say Multnomah County and Marion County and be on probation in both counties. If the offender has a violation of probation in both counties, then what happens currently is that the offender would need to go to the judge, to court in both counties, and be sanctioned, or at least have a hearing on that probation violation in separate counties, which can be fairly time-consuming. What this bill does is allows the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to establish procedures for consolidating multiple probation violations.
All right. Ann Christian, come on up. We've got you listed as a witness. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, good morning, members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian. I'm here today as the staff person to the Chief Justice's State Criminal Justice Advisory Committee. Counsel has explained Senate Bill 18 and grossed exactly as the Chief State Criminal Justice Advisory Committee has.
I think I can
wanted.
Save you a little time on this.
Pardon?
Did anybody object to this bill in the Senate?
They did not.
And there's no one here objecting to this bill. And as amended, you're satisfied with it?
We're very satisfied.
Why don't we see if members of the committee have questions for you? I think the committee's okay with this bill.
Thank you.
We'll move into work session on Senate Bill 18A. Do I have a motion, Representative Cesari?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 18 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You've heard the motion, colleagues. Is there any question, any debate? Seeing none, any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is carried, and Senate Bill 18 is sent to the floor with a due pass. Representative Simmons, would you be the carrier, or Representative Sincere, or did someone want to volunteer? Representative Simmons. All right, this closes the work session on Senate Bill 18. Next up is Senate Bill 944. Oh, Senator Courtney is here. Senator Courtney, let me ask you quickly, did you have anyone else you wanted to have? Wait. No problem. We're just moving through some other things then. Senate Bill 944 will convene the public hearing and ask counsel to summarize the measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this bill has to do with is, excuse me, the definition of forcible compulsion, and that is a phrase that is used in some sex offenses, like sodomy 1, rape 1, unlawful sexual penetration 1. Part of the current definition says that forcible compulsion means physical force that overcomes earnest resistance. So in other words, under the law, if there is not earnest resistance, it may not constitute forcible compulsion and may not be rape. What this bill would do in part is to provide that the definition instead is forcible compulsion means to compel by physical force and removes the requirement that the prosecutor needs to prove that there was earnest resistance. It also adds a provision that a lack of verbal or physical resistance does not constitute consent. Those
right.
are the main provisions of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Gina McClard, Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. No, I say David Niebel is here. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, I'm David Niebel from the Oregon Law Center. I signed Ms. McClard up. She called from the freeway saying that she was stuck in traffic and asked me to sign her up.
She may have good news for you. Was there any objection to this bill in the Senate?
Ms. Swenson appeared and objected in the Senate, but that, I believe that was the only objection.
Was it modified to deal with any of those objections?
There was some amendments. You're dealing with the engrossed version. I think District Attorney Dale Penn from Marion County and Ms. McClard met with Ms. Swenson and got as far as they could in negotiating some amendments that would be acceptable to...
All right, well, we have James Rice here. Perhaps I can call you up, Mr. Rice. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the surprise call as a witness on Senate Bill 944. This came over from the Senate. We only had Gina McClard. Now Mr. David Niebel signed up. Gina McClard stuck in traffic. I understand Ingrid Swenson had presented some concerns in the Senate on this bill, and wanted to see if those concerns have been resolved, if they're still pending.
Chairman Mannix, members of the committee, those concerns still are pending. When I read the bill, I took a look at page 2, where they discuss the lack of verbal or physical resistance, not constituting consent. This particular provision reminded me of a situation that received prominent play in Eugene in the newspapers involving a student at the University of Oregon. This is a very fine student. The student was headed for Harvard Law School. And what I thought was a curious situation arose in that charges were leveled against the student that he had impermissibly engaged in sexual conduct with two young women. And this is the kind of thing that drew attention. What surprised me was that the women came forward and said, we thought it was okay that this young man engaged in oral sex with us. We didn't mind that he engaged in another form of sex, which I'll simply refer to as sodomy, but we did not consent to intercourse with him. Apparently, they never said no. They then sought to bring criminal charges against him. The matter, he obtained a very fine attorney. Criminal charges ultimately were considered but not brought, but he was tried in a student court. And what struck me at the time was, when someone doesn't say no, when someone doesn't say stop, when someone doesn't say don't do that, it leads to misunderstandings between people. And in the clarity of this room, the kinds of conduct that's engaged into between two people when they're in an intimate situation is such that I think if this committee was to delete the verbal aspect of this bill, it would lend itself to clarity. I think that individuals who are engaged in intimate behavior both have an obligation to be clear as to their intentions. And this particular provision, I believe the young man did not end up going to Harvard because he was temporarily at least dismissed from the University of Oregon, and it took a long, long time to straighten the matter out when the word no, stop, I do not consent would have really clarified the issue for all parties.
So your suggestion is on page 2, we should take out verbal or?
I would suggest we do that.
Mr. Niebel, what's your reaction to that?
Representative Mannix, I'm sorry, I feel unable to respond. I'm here sort of as a placeholder.
Is Gina McClard still in traffic on her way?
I believe she is. We were expecting Mr. Penn to be here also, so might I defer?
I thought that this was a no-brainer, that is, that everybody was in accord. Since that's not the case, and that's fine, we're here to not litigate, I should hope. What I'll do is hold us in suspense and recess the hearing and wait until Gina McClard arrives. And that way, you know, we can hold on to this and see what we should do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll go into recess on the public hearing on Senate Bill 944. And Senator Courtney, do you have your team here?
I have.
You still have? Oh, you do have them?
Yes,
okay.
I'm all here.
Then we will move into work session with invited testimony on Senate Bill 844. I'll convene the work session and invite Senator Courtney to come forward with his special guest. And Senator, I'll let you present your guest as you will and hear the testimony during this work session.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Peter Courtney, State Senator from District 17, which is the Salem-Kaiser area. I was here last week on Senate Bill 844, a bill that came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously and off the Senate floor, I believe, unanimously with some excused absences. And one of the things that we talked about is how I'm trying to create, through the help of a school safety zone around our schools. And the reason is the gentleman to my left, to your right, his name is Mike Kolb. Mike Kolb, K-O-L-B, is the principal of North Salem High School, the home of the Vikings, the oldest high school in the city of Salem and Kaiser area. Originally, it was the Salem High School, and now it's one of the five four-year high schools. And it's the first time I've met the principal at Sprague High School, who's been here about a year, came up from the California school system, Mark
Davalos.
And Sprague High School is, I believe, the biggest 4A high school in all of Salem. It's in excess of 2,000 students. North is 1,800 students. So this community has five 4A high schools, and they volunteered to come here today. It was the Principal Kolb that approached me months ago. I wanted the school liaison's officer to come, which is the police officer in North. I found out that he, at the last moment, had to get the official approval of the Salem City Council before he could come to these kinds of meetings. Which I regret very much because he is the cop. He is the law enforcement officers that works with the schools to deal with some of the questions and concerns that were brought up. Now, I don't know how you want to handle this because both these individuals know the bill that I introduced. They understand why I had to drop back from the Georgia statute, which was the original statute, which we felt was unconstitutional, and Georgia simply says, you're within 1,000 feet of the school, you're a goner. We put there that there had to be notification. A lot of other things worked very hard on the bill. And so I don't know how you want these two individuals to speak. I hope they get a chance to speak because they have to deal with the everyday life of being a principal of a major high school in my community. But I have a feeling that their testimonies, including Mark, who came out of California, who, as I understand, has a similar bill and has dealt with similar situation, is very learned in these matters, not to mention Mike, who's had to deal with it up close and in person because he's the one who came to me and gave me the specific example that involves gang members as well as sex offenders. So, Chair Mannix, and of course we have with us
Kevin Campbell,
who's also very supportive of the bill and on behalf of
the Chiefs.
So here we are. I don't know how you want to handle it, Mr. Rex.
Start right off to your left and we'll work our way across.
Thank you, Chairperson Mannix and members of the Judicial Committee. I believe the record has a letter from me that was presented to you by Peter during his first testimony, so I'll not go back over that ground. I guess what I'd like to say is we live in challenging times throughout our entire community, but certainly in the school business with issues of safety boiling to the top seriously over the last few years and seeming as though they're not getting better. I believe that we have an opportunity in this state to help schools provide a safe environment. Schools work very hard to keep the facility itself safe, but where they're extremely vulnerable is with their perimeter. High schools and middle schools, I've been the principal at North Salem High School for 3 years, and I was at Waldo Middle School at 9 years, and many of the experiences are similar in nature in that secondary schools tend to be gathering places at dismissal time and during special events. Large numbers of non-students show up, some for legitimate reasons, some for non-legitimate reasons. And specifically, some events that we've had to deal with at North Salem parallel some at Waldo. We've had a number of situations where we've had suspended students return to school, and they legally, according to our police interpretation of the statute, can be on the public sidewalk, which is property of the city. And they will arrive at school and hang out looking for the person that they happen to be in conflict with. And that frequently has led to confrontations, some physical, many verbal, that create a pretty trying and unsafe situation. Additionally, well, most recently comes to mind two rival gangs in Salem that are involved in the leftover aftermath of a shooting last summer and a court case that has been going on. One of those gangs has been daily arriving at North Salem High School, parking across the street, hanging out on the sidewalk, making comments to students that attend North Salem High School who are affiliated through friendship with members of the rival gang. And we feel seriously that that's a time bomb ticking, and we're quite concerned about it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krasinski.
I don't know if this is appropriate. We're going through a lot of stuff. I've got a lot of questions that I'm getting. I don't know if you want us to wait or do you want us to...
I'm going to have each of the two education witnesses testify, and after each one, we'll ask, have you ask questions. Thank you. Thank you for asking. Go ahead.
And I could go on with case after case where we've had this kind of situation, but I know as a staff, we have tremendous presence at dismissal time around school to help manage these situations. We get tremendous cooperation from Salem Police Department in saturating the area with patrol cars. But again, those are simply efforts to maintain a situation that we think we could control and eliminate if we had the ability to trespass the undesirables and have them locate further from school. Currently, our police officers report to us unless they engage in criminal behavior or there is some probable cause issue, they cannot confront or detain these folks. And we need some help if we're going to maintain the safety during the dismissal and activity time. We've had a number of occasions also at after-school dances or in the evening where we've had like behavior from outsiders coming in and hanging out on the public street, on the public sidewalk, making comments to our students as they come and go from the dance. And we approached Peter at a soccer game, ironically, to talk about, or I talked to him about this issue, talked to him about some information I had from Georgia, and I appreciate and respect the work he did to have a bill before you.
What I'll do is I'll have our other educator testify and then ask for questions for both of you, or and then and Mr. Campbell can also pitch in. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Distinguished Chair and members of the committee, good morning. This is my first opportunity to be able to speak to a legislative committee. My name is Mark Davalos. I'm principal at Sprague High School. Recently moved here last July from Southern California, where I've been an educator since 1976. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about SB 844, the School Safety Zone Bill. It was Robert Schuller who said, "Problems are not signs, they are guidelines." I have encountered many stop signs during my career as an educator. There are so many problems facing children today, and they come from so many directions. We have society's problems, financial problems, family problems, drugs, violence, and gangs, to mention a few. These stop signs can have a devastating effect on a student's chance for educational success. These obstacles can make the efforts of teachers fall on deaf ears. These difficulties only make administrators' efforts to create a safe haven while where learning is the primary goal harder and harder to realize. These are some of the reasons why I ask that you support the School Safety Zone Bill. Two high school assignments ago, we had gang homes across the street from school. I understand that everyone has a right to live where they choose. When our students were afraid to walk past these homes, when these individuals stood in front of their houses and shouted comments at PE classes, and when things got so out of control that a gang fight resulted in some students being injured because of these individuals, we asked, where was the law, where was our protection? These same individuals threatened custodians at night and threw junk into our pool. We also suspected that they were selling drugs to students before school, at lunch, and after school as well. The probation department helped remove many of the teens and adults from those homes because of their terror, but we suffered. At my previous high school, we conducted athletic competition at the parks department fields next to the school. The park was a regular hangout for gang members. During a tennis match, a gang member walked through the court and was reproached by a visiting tennis player. The player was assaulted, and our relationship with that student and the school was injured. Our own team continued to play in fear. Our administrator that day had walked over to the softball game to observe a loud parent that I ultimately had to serve with a trespass notice. He was intoxicated and was questioning the coach's decisions. Because of a similar bill, in California on loitering and trespassing, the notice I presented allowed the police to take more serious action if the disturbance was repeated, and so the adult never returned. And looking at these problems as guidelines, SB 844 would assist schools with an ability to diplomatically inform individuals to stay away from school when their behavior disturbs the business and activities of our school. The increased penalty and enforcement would help us keep schools as safe havens and remove some of those stop signs that block the path to an education. With these examples in mind, I ask that you help make our schools safer by considering the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Davalos. Representative Pazansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not really sure where to start because, to me, we haven't heard the answers that I need to hear as to support this bill right now, and that is what's happening on enforcement currently today. I mean, I don't see by setting up a zone, and I'm going to ask questions as to why 1,000 feet versus 2,000 feet, 500 feet, whatever it may be. But under our current law, disorderly conduct, what I'm hearing at this point, many of these people may be hanging out there, but they may not be reaching the level of disorderly conduct. So I don't understand how, by enhancing that penalty, we're going to address that problem. That's, I guess, as a first overall perspective. I don't know if you want to respond to that or if you want me to ask more specific questions. Current trespass. I don't see why you cannot, as the supervising or authority on that school grounds, trespass anyone off of your property if they're causing disturbance or they're there not doing, I guess, legitimate business. And I don't see why we have to, I mean, California, you did it in California, Mark. I don't understand why you can't do that today.
Just one thing I must say, and I'll let them talk. I chose 1,000 feet, Representative Pazansky, because we already do certain things with 1,000 feet, and other states have chosen 1,000 feet. So that's simply to coincide with prostitution and drug sales within 1,000 feet of a school. So that's why the 1,000 feet was chosen to you know, not to create 2,000, 3,000, you know, and that was the reason that was chosen by me. So I think I owe that to these two witnesses to know that.
That's fine.
So the question is, why not use the trespass statute? And what I'll do is I'll ask Mr. Cole to respond and then Mr. Davalos.
We do use the current trespass law, and we thank you for that. It's a tool. The issue is when we trespass someone, the boundary is the sidewalk. So we cannot move them away from access to our students. And what we're asking is that when we trespass someone, that we can move them away from the school so that they can't continue to interact with the students. At dismissal time, all those kids go out into the sidewalk area, parking lot area, and can interact with people who have been trespassed, albeit for suspension, gang activity, or some other problem in school.
Let me have Mr. Davalos respond then, and I think Representative Pazansky has another question. Mr.
Sure.
Davalos.
A similar example that I can give is probably the number of students that we've had to trespass and adults away from the school that linger about and still pose a threat to the other parents that come to the school to pick up their students or their children and wonder why we can't remove these people indefinitely from the area when they've already posed a threat. We are able to have them move a certain distance across the street from the school, but unfortunately some of these individuals think that it's within their rights and it's okay as long as the law doesn't state that they have to be any further than that, that even though it is intimidation, they're within their rights to be able to stand across the street from the school and pose their threat to the students, even though we've trespassed them off our own property. And that really causes an enormous amount of work for me as an administrator in trying to deal with the parents on why that's as far as we can go.
Let me draw from that for a moment and ask Representative Pazansky to pick up. We have exclusion zones that are allowed when somebody's found guilty of a certain kind of offense where you can declare an exclusion zone and say you are now excluded from this zone, which can be beyond the school property. And I'm wondering if that sort of approach, rather than this business of dealing with disorderly conduct and moving up, but an exclusion zone that's used, say, in downtown where there's people that have been habitually hanging around a certain bus stop and creating problems and they're convicted of a crime there, as part of it, they're excluded from that area. And if they come back in fact, it may be that it's even done without a conviction. Portland's had an issue and they've used exclusion zones. Is this an option that might be of use? And maybe that's a question for Mr. Campbell or Senator Courtney, but I'll throw it out to all four of you.
Chair Mannix, I'm open to how you want to define this zone. I'm just trying to help these two gentlemen and people in these positions to be able to do what I think everybody here would agree they need to do, given the fact that safety for their students is critically important.
And the goal is to keep them away.
Right. Would you please tell whether or not the sidewalk that leads from the sidewalk up the main drag there to the that foyer at North Salem High School, is that sidewalk considered city property?
No. The main entrance from the, along the curb sidewalk, once you start up that walkway, you're on district property.
Okay, which, okay, district property meaning?
School district. The city owns, there's about a 10 or 12-foot strip alongside the streets that's the right-of-way, that's the city's property, and the sidewalk is a part of that zone. But once you leave that and go up the main walk up to the school, that is district property, and we can exclude from there.
Well, your problem right now is ingress and egress.
I want to clarify that for you.
Well, your problem is that that sidewalk, using that one visual example in my mind, I mean, the walkway from the school runs right onto that sidewalk. In fact, there's another walkway to the north side that does the same thing. So if you've got people hanging around who've been trespassed off the property, they can still be there. In fact, they can also go over to where the parking lot is because the sidewalk surrounds the parking lot. So that's your problem. Okay. Representative Pazanza?
Let me.
All right. Did you want to comment on
a comment? Charged with the management of the safety of the students is a huge responsibility, and I know that my peers throughout the state take that responsibility very seriously. I guess one of the reasons we're asking for help specifically in this direction is that dismissal time and activities are the time that we have the least management control over large numbers of people. When we're in session and students are moving from class to class, that's manageable. We know where the kids are going to be. We know what's expected of them. They know what's expected. At dismissal time, it looks like an ant colony moving out to, and we are really in a stressed management situation from a safety point of view at that time. And we have no control over who can be adjacent to our property. And I mean 1 foot outside of our property. We have no control over managing that. We can keep them off, which the trespass law allows us to do. But what we're asking for is to push that perimeter out. Let us get students on buses, in cars, begin the travel to increase
safety. Mr. Chair, what I have in front of me is a bill does not do that. The only thing this bill does is enhance a penalty for an existing crime of disorderly conduct. And so I don't see anything here that's going to, in my opinion, run afoul to due process to give you the right to say that you're off this property and now I'm going to control another 1,000 feet of taking someone off the property. That bill, that's not in this bill, at least the way I read it. The only thing that's going to happen is we're going to enhance an existing penalty from a Class B misdemeanor to a Class A misdemeanor. It's not going to give you any additional authority to go beyond what your school, what your authority is with on the school grounds. So I mean, maybe I'm missing something.
Well, I think the point is that the enhanced penalty applies within the 1,000 feet beyond the campus, so that's the sense. But let's get from the non-legal witness's perspective. You gentlemen are here to tell us about the problem and ask us to come up with a solution, not necessarily telling us that a particular solution is the one, but your problem is with ingress and egress, you have individuals who are either suspended students or expelled students or non-students who are hanging around and who are disturbing the peace and security and tranquility of the campus and of the students who are coming and going through their activity right off the campus, whether or not it be heckling or fighting or jeering, whatever else, and you want to be able to at least identify some of those individuals and say, back off. Stay away from this sidewalk. Now, in terms of free speech, if they were there picketing saying they wanted pay raises for teachers or they wanted pay reductions for teachers, they would have free speech rights and we couldn't tell them to get off the sidewalk. But if somebody does something to impair access or to contribute to a hostile environment, there may be some issues where we can then say to someone, you're excluded. What we could do is study there's some Portland ordinances. I'm going to check to see if there are statutes that allow the government to say to some individuals who've been identified as having done certain things, back off. I don't know if it requires a conviction. Maybe Mr. Campbell can help us with that.
Not sure, Mr. Chair.
That might be part of the solution here. But let me open this up to more questions. And Representative Pazanski and then Representative Bowman.
What enforceability are we having right now on the existing laws? I mean, that's my frustration is I'm hearing let's go in and enhance an existing law, give a stiffer penalty
But I have not heard about Salem Police coming in and citing these people going to court, the judge having the opportunity to put a safe zone as part of their probation, that if they violate it, they're going to be back before the court for that. Are these people at this point being cited by the police and taken to court that we're concerned about?
Do you want to respond?
I'm not sure if I can completely answer your question, but at Sprague High School, one of the reasons I so much wanted to come to Oregon and work here with and in a school like Sprague, which really does not have the kind of traffic that Mr. Kolb has at North High School, it is what I was looking for. I believe we have a better environment there and a safer, more secure environment, free of the kind of traffic that I was so accustomed to. I offered to come here to speak today about my experiences in the past. I have had some very frustrating experiences where, even with the laws that were written to protect us, to allow us to trespass students, it was somewhat vague in that, once again, as you gave example, we were able to trespass students off of our own property, but that still allowed them to linger about the school in such proximity that the intimidation still disrupted our daily activities. It disrupted our athletic events after school. It put us on a high level of alert every day while we were at school, every day of the week, every day of the year. It is reasons why in California we end up putting, you know, iron gates around schools and you know, high, you know, chain link fencing around schools and stand out there like we are guarding some sort of prison. And I don't believe that that is a good environment for students when they are fearful of the outside world and the dangers of the outside world right there at the edge of the school boundary. I think what we need is a zone where we feel comfortable, we feel protected, where we feel that these elements do not have access or the right to come in and disturb us. That once they've been notified that they are not accepted there in this area, that they have to refrain from being close to the school and their intimidation along with it. And I believe that that is why I'm supporting this.
Mr. Davalos, one of the things in the bill is that it elevates disorderly conduct from a Class B misdemeanor to a Class A misdemeanor, and it looks like that would incorporate students as well as non-students. Mm-hmm. What is your perspective on that? Is that a good idea or a bad idea to include, say, students who are fighting in the hallway, moving up their disorderly conduct from a Class B to a Class A?
I think that the reason we have had such an increase in violent crimes at school among students is because the consequences haven't always met the situation appropriately and given everyone else the message that these type of activities will not be tolerated. I think that for the more serious crimes, the more serious penalty is warranted now.
Right. Representative Bowman has... Do you have another answer there, Senator Courtney?
Yes, I would agree. I think zero means zero, and until we make a strong statement that we're not going to tolerate violence and that type of behavior, that we're not going to see a change until we make a strong statement. I've worked very closely with Salem Police Department on issues that you raised in the beginning, Representative Mannix. And one of the issues is the police do battle with probable cause, and when we've asked for help, they will follow cars that are cruising in the area making comments to students, and they'll find a taillight out or something like that. In fact, last week, did pull the car over and found weapons in the car, a pair of brass knuckles and a baseball bat. But they're hampered a bit by their ability to engage and intervene with these folks as they see them at a given moment without probable cause. We have information about specific involvements they have and specific interactions with our students because of problems in the community. And for them to be in our school area, it's real clear why they're there. I mean, they have no business with the school. They're not picking a student up. They're here because so-and-so is at our school, and they've got a problem with them, and they know they can find them there.
Yeah, I've been holding off. Representative Bowman, sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No problem. You asked one of my questions. I want to follow up on what Representative Pazanski was asking, though. If you currently call the Salem Police Department because you have people creating a disturbance outside of your school, do they come and issue citations to those people who are causing problems?
Yes. If we're to the point where they have blocked traffic are actually in the process of physically confronting an individual, harassing an individual, breaking a statute. They do act, they do have arrested people for that. Sometimes their presence and intervention simply disperses the activity, so it's not 100%, but yes, they do respond.
And if I could follow up, Mr. Chair. The A3-dash amendments, have you gentlemen seen those amendments that we just got this morning? This suggests creating a school safety zone alliance, and the entities that should be represented currently all serve on the local public safety council. And so my question is, why would we create another entity that has all those same individuals on it if, in fact, all local communities currently have a local public safety council?
I think I should tell you about the genealogy of the A3 amendments. Representative Morissette had some legislation along these lines, and he asked that we consider adding it to this bill.
Oh.
That's why we have that.
So it's not the sponsors of the bills.
But it's a good question, because I need to tell Representative Morissette whether or not the committee's interested in his amendment, too. I don't know if Senator Courtney's seen this. Do you have a reaction to this amendment, Senator Courtney? If it's fuel to help move the vehicle, yes.
Here, so I got to be very
drag,
careful.
No.
I had a very tough week over here, so I got to be careful last week. It's a nice amendment, but compared to what we're trying to do here, it doesn't accomplish what the bill intends to do, Representative Max. I have to say that's flat out, and I don't, with all due respect to my colleague, Representative Morris said, I have incredible respect for and for his knowledge in many areas. It's a nice amendment, but it doesn't do what...
Well, I would suspect that Representative Sinceri is not too hot on it either, since it was in another bill that education decided they didn't want to move. So I just, you know, Representative Morris had inquired, so here it is.
I have one final question, Mr.
Sure,
Chair. Thank you. I think the concern that this committee expressed last week when Senator Courtney first presented this bill to us was how broad it appears. And current behavior, I mean, let's face it, young people are loud, they're noisy. When you've got a large group moving, for the untrained ear, you know, it could sound like it's a fight and they're actually having a real conversation. And so the concern, I think, that was expressed last week was, how will this be implemented? How does this really work on the ground? And are we going to criminalize some behavior that is normally youth behavior at the expense of free speech and just kids being kids?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bowman, Kevin Campbell, Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, I think that the general posture of law enforcement in its school environment is never to arrest first if they can determine that there's some other way of addressing or dispersing the problem. I mean, the last thing that we want to do, and one of the reasons the safety zone is a potential answer to this, is that now law enforcement is regularly called to, like, North and other high schools in the region and around the state. And this area or this environment of intimidation that occurs both because of people that are troublemakers on the sidewalk and, frankly, because there's police cars all the time in the school environment, creates an environment that I think is contrary to a good learning environment. Kids walking out of school every day wondering why the police are there, I mean, that's a concern. So law enforcement's always looking for a way to disperse and deal with the issue without arrest. I mean, the last thing we need to do is move more kids into the juvenile system if there's another way to address it. But in situations of serious intimidation, where there's gang activity and kids are coming out of the school frightened about their lives, that's the kind of thing that destroys the school environment. And that's one of the reasons that the Chiefs Association has said, you know, this is an idea that has some merit, an idea that we believe will help us to further address this issue, not through additional arrests necessarily, but through providing more of a buffer. And I think that's the intent and why we would be supportive at this point.
President Brzezinski, sure. Representative Brzezinski has a shot, but then Representative Sinceri, and then back to Representative Bowman.
Representative Manning, a response to Representative Bowman is that, and I believe it's existing statute, the definition of disorderly conduct. All of the statements there, with the exception of B, are of serious concern to school people. every one of those issues is something we have to deal with on a daily basis, and I really appreciate your insight into B, because the just the music that kids enjoy today is loud. And I don't know that, that statute needs to be changed. I think people involved with working with adolescents understand the need for music, understand what they enjoy and how they enjoy it. And noise has not been an issue for us. It has been, by definition, every one of those other issues, though.
Now, it's going to be Representative Brzezinski, then Representative Cenceri, Representative Bowman, and then Representative Gianella, and Representative Hansen. I'll give each of you a couple of question shots, but then we're going to try to resolve that. And Representative Simmons, I'm going to put you in the line, too, just in case. Representative Brzezinski.
You're in the queue.
Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still baffled as to where we're actually going to get with this bill as it's currently written. To me, it's extremely broad. Not only does it, you know, we've all talked about kids, but within that 1,000 feet, you've got residential areas. They're all going to be under this enhanced penalty. And then also teachers. What if the teachers go on strike or classified workers go on strike and they want to picket out in front of the school? They could potentially find themselves on the receiving end of an enhanced penalty for disorderly conduct based on their what they're doing. And what I'm hearing what you really want to be able to do as the supervisor or the authoritative people to be able to trust. And I really think you're going to have some due process and equal protection issues that you're going to have to work through to accomplish that, because why should any one individual at a school be able to be empowered to tell anyone, not just students but or non-students that are youth, that you are now being trespassed? Because that's what I'm hearing that you really want to do, is move them out 1,000 feet away from the school. Senate Bill 844 doesn't do that. The only thing it does at this point is enhance a penalty if certain conduct, which is already in law, happens within 1,000 feet of the school. So I don't think you get where you want to be.
Well, the point here then is we're trying to do body work, and the question is whether we have the right tools. And you gentlemen are telling us what you need. How we fashion the remedy is really sort of up to us, I assume. Senator Courtney, did you want to respond to Representative Brzezinski's comment?
No, I brought these individuals who deal with the real life. I think the committee would rather hear from them than hear from me. And so I brought them here today because they have to deal with it on an everyday basis. I think they're showing they're not arbitrary types of people, that they understand kids. They're not out to get kids, but they have got some real safety issues on their hands, and they're there to try to deal with them. And you know, just the idea of dismissals and everything, I hadn't thought of that. They're giving you the real. You need to hear from them. I just ask that you don't ask them to be lawyers, because
that's fine.
The thing that I don't think they're prepared to do. And I just say that in all fairness to them. I had to be very frank with you.
I'm going to interrupt everybody. Because of the time frame, I'm going to be really strict about letting people talk, and I'm going to turn to Representative Cenceri next.
Well, I'll just share with you what my concerns are, and then you can respond. I'm concerned that, somewhat in line with what Representative Brzezinski said, if you've got someone who lives directly across the street from the school or within 1,000 square feet, you've got a young boy that lives in that home and goes to the school, he's a student there, and he's home standing on his porch, somebody walks by, flips cigarette butts in their yard, and they get in a yelling match back and forth, guy standing on his own porch in the home he lives in becomes a criminal because he's could be charged with a Class A misdemeanor. I see that as a problem, and things like that as a problem. I'm concerned that we're going to try to make criminals out of people who get in yelling matches at a dance or something. I'm concerned that we're not enforcing the laws that are already on the books. You talked about a tennis player who was assaulted. We have laws against assault. We have laws against trespassing, laws against disorderly conduct. And if we're not enforcing those laws, then what good is it going to do us to create another law? And what do we do about the high schools that are out in the suburban areas that don't have sidewalks, that don't have definitive lines? I don't know how we're going to deal with that, because we have to think about schools all over the state when we do this, not just the schools in Salem. And so I would say then, why can't the city council do something? If you have a particular problem high school in your city, why can't the city council do something that would affect that school and the local police, who are under the authority of that city council, are the ones that you call to respond to the problems anyway? So those are some of the concerns.
Mr. Davalos and then Mr. Cole.
Well,
I think in response to the last two comments by the distinguished gentleman, Representative Plazanski and Representative Sinceri, I come with no other agenda than the safety of the students that I am in charge of and have been charged with protecting and providing a safe haven for an educational, for educational reasons. I'm not looking to infringe on anyone's rights, to assembly, to distribute material, to do things out in public that everyone has the right to. What I am concerned with, and experience has shown me that there are individuals, there are elements that after having dealt with them for one offense or violation or threat or something similar to that, that there needs to be a way to ask them to stay away from the school in a reasonable way, from a reasonable distance, so that that threat is then removed. So school does not have to daily witness and have that sense of threat and intimidation.
All right. Mr. Kolb?
I would agree with what Mark said, and I would additionally say that in the case of the assaulted tennis player today, we can arrest that person for the serious charge of assault, which is more serious than disorderly currently, and we can trespass them to the edge of the property, and then the harassment and the intimidation continues, and that is a key piece. The other comment I would make is that the letter of the law is always a difficult thing to interpret and enforce. And in the case of the student who lives across the street, at the time there's a problem, I think you work with the family and the offender, and you talk about what's reasonable here. And certainly going out and setting up a lawn chair on their sidewalk right across the street from the school during dismissal time, I think ought to be negotiable. It doesn't mean that they're on house arrest or anything, but they could be inside during dismissal time. They could still have their friends come over who were consensual to coming. But you negotiate those things. We live with 1,000-foot zones related to other things, and I think we can adapt and learn how to do that with a statute like this.
All right. Now, the way we're going to progress, I've got Representatives Gianella, Bowman, Hansen, and possibly Simmons up. The point that I'd like to pause here for a minute and ask Committee Counsel, who is a former Deputy DA from Multnomah County, to outline for you and for the committee something that's done in Portland about exclusion zones. I've talked to him about that, and I'd like him to outline how that works in Portland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I would outline at this point would be a couple of things that happen in Portland. There are drug-free zones and prostitution-free zones, and I know that that is a little bit different from what you're targeting, but the concept is perhaps similar. For example, in prostitution-free zones, there are certain areas identified in the city of Portland that are highly infested with prostitutes and also persons searching for prostitutes. There's, I think, three areas. Those have been outlined by the city council as prostitution-free zones. Now, a prostitute or a person looking for a prostitute who is engaging in activity in that area is not, by virtue of that reason alone, committing a crime. But what happens is if a person is either arrested, charged with, or convicted of prostitution, for example, then the person, either as part of the sentence or at the time of arrest, and for constitutional reasons it needs to be one of the two, is given an exclusion form by the officer or by the judge or by the district attorney. There is a map on the back with the areas in Portland which are considered prostitution-free zones. The person signs the form, as does the judge and the deputy district attorney, and the person is notified that within the next year, if they enter that area for any reason at all, even if they're not engaging in illegal activity, then they will be committing the crime of criminal trespass in the second degree. The drug-free zone exclusion is largely the same concept, except as it relates to drugs.
Now, the reason I brought this up is I wonder if we couldn't have in statute a school safety zone that identifies school property and says that under certain circumstances, a perpetrator who has already demonstrated through his conduct that he's a difficult person could receive such an exclusion form. Granted, the exclusion form would have to be individualized in some cases. If someone's a former student or a student who lives nearby, you can't exclude him from his home. And the exclusion, it might be 100 feet from the border of the campus rather than 1,000. It sounds like your real problem is truly along the border, not 10 blocks away or 5 blocks away. I'm just throwing that out as a piece of information to chew on a little bit as another opportunity that might work. And then it's Representative Gianella's turn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Cole, when you called the Salem police and they responded, how many cases were there that you called the Salem police and they responded?
We have a liaison officer present in our building at all times, and we use him daily. An exact count I couldn't give you. There have been at least 8 to 10 occasions this year where we've called for saturation by having traffic patrol in the gang task force present in our area where we've had issues with rival gangs present. So we saturate the area with police cars.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. When you called the Salem police and they responded, did the judge give an order to the offender to stay away from the school?
Not to my knowledge. And not on every occasion was there arrest. On occasion where there has been arrest, we've trespassed them from the school property. But we haven't been able to push them further out.
Thank you.
All right. President Donovan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on Representative Sinceri's question. Has the local school board or the local city council taken a position on what changes they could make to address the issues that you're concerned with?
The school district has exercised through policy their right to establish rules and expectations for behavior for all users of the facility on school district property, but there has been no effort at the city level to expand that.
And that's just significant because Mr. Horton and I were having a little sidebar conversation, and the way this would work, the city, for instance, would probably have to issue the exclusion order because we're not talking about school property. We're talking about the city. And the city would have to have the map with the schools designated and say, you're excluded. That'd be a process for the city to adopt through ordinance, just as a piece of information. See, Representative Bowman, did you have any further questions? I think it was Representative Hanson, then Representative Pozanski. All right.
Well, I think the school safety zone, the exclusionary zone, might be a better way to go in terms of really focusing on what your problem is, because the just upgrading the Class B misdemeanor to Class A, I think that's going to be real limited in terms of how it's going to impact the kids. There's one other piece of research that we might be able to do. There's some issues surrounding abortion clinics where I think it's called a bubble of protection around those, that where there may be some wording that differentiates between the political protest, the free speech issues, and the actual disruptive conduct that that gets into issues of public safety. And there may be some language that has been developed that works between those two issues that we might be able to put into effect in this era. So those would be my two approaches to deal with it would be the enhanced safety zones that the chair's talked about, and then maybe bubble protection. The other one I think we might look at is reducing it from 1,000 feet to maybe 250, so that you're not casting a net. 1,000 feet, if you're talking about going down a side street away from a school, is a pretty significant distance where really you want to focus on the sidewalks and the stuff immediately facing the schools.
There's two other elements to this. One is the fact that generally you cannot detain juveniles for B and C misdemeanors. There's a bill going through the process that would change that, but you've got ABC felonies, ABC misdemeanors, and the B and C misdemeanors, as I understand it, generally you cannot detain a juvenile for committing those, and the law would change to allow detention for B and C misdemeanors, which means you could have more effective law enforcement. Secondly, police cannot arrest an adult for a B or C misdemeanor which has not been committed in their presence unless the police have a warrant. And that, too, is subject to legislation which is changing that to say that they could. And the reason I mention this is we've been dumbing down the B and C misdemeanors all along. We make it hard to enforce them, then we wonder why everybody wants to move everything up to a Class A misdemeanor. I know why. It's because that's where you get your search and seizure, that's where you get your arrests, and then we wonder why the sanctions seem to be so tough. There is legislation, again, going through this process that will put some more teeth back into B and C misdemeanors. and disorderly conduct is a B misdemeanor. And there's an example, unless the police see it happening, for an adult, they can't arrest, generally speaking. And they have to go out and get a warrant, come back. So you're losing some effective immediate activity right now under current law. So those two changes, too, may change some of the atmosphere. I'll refer out one other concept and then pick up with Representative Przanski. It occurs to me that school districts could contract with district attorneys to provide additional, more aggressive law enforcement as to school property and adjoining areas. I had a little sidebar conversation with Dale Penn, the Marion County District Attorney, and I just asked, how much more a year would you need in your budget to hire another district attorney whose job is to focus on school-related crime? About $100,000 a year. That's $200,000 in a biennium. I'm just throwing out the idea, wouldn't it be great if the Salem Chrysler School District provided some funds to the Marion County District Attorney with a request? And my question would be whether or not they need legal authorization to do that. Remember, they're just providing additional funding to get focused law enforcement as to current laws. You could develop a no-tolerance policy on the school campus and adjoining areas, because it's the district attorney, not the school police or something, and just say from now on, people screwing around in this area, we're going to focus law enforcement, and we will have a DA whose only job it is to go after these bad guys. Just another thought. Representative Przanski, you want to pick up?
Thank you. Gentlemen, I hear what you're trying to do. Where I went to school, we had over 3,000 students, and it was a heck of an opportunity for a lot of things to happen. It's a closed campus. It was in an area that seems very similar to South Salem, South San Antonio, or North Salem, excuse me. And but I just don't see us getting there through state legislation. To me, this is a local issue that should be addressed on the local level, because if we try to put some type of master plan or boilerplate on the state level, I don't think it's going to have to be massaged and fixed for each county or each city or each school district. And I know school districts now do contract with local law enforcement, and I assume that's probably the arrangement that Salem Chrysler has now, so you do have a liaison officer on site. And the other thing is, it just seems to me from a perspective, from a legal perspective, administrators are going to be putting themselves in a very vulnerable position, potentially for liability, for you to be trespassing people or putting them out notices without having some type of due process and equal protection in place on individuals within this zone. And it seems that it would be more appropriate to do as our staff council has discussed that Portland's done, where it's again at the local level, but city council makes these rules. They work them through the legal process, getting the attorneys involved to make sure everyone's rights are protected at the same time you're protecting your students. And I've got to say, as the bill is written today, I cannot support it, because I don't see where we're going to gain anything by just enhancing the penalty for a certain geographic area, and it doesn't seem like we're really getting to the root problems or enforcing current law to get these people to get their attention.
I think that was more of a comment than a question, so you don't have to respond unless you wanted to say something in reply. I recognize the message from you gentlemen is, help, that's your message, and you're saying you need some tools, you need some resources, and then it's up to us to fashion those resources and tools. And I'm not kidding about the money, by the way. If we continue to enhance school appropriations, we ought to talk about dedicating some of that, or at least authorizing school districts, if we need to do so, to allow them to dedicate some of that money to district attorney enforcement on school campuses and adjoining school campuses, if the school district so chooses. It might be a good investment. I will mention for 30 seconds, when I was the counsel for the Guam Department of Education, and they had a tremendous truancy problem, we found that the 7 truant officers for 23,000 students were not getting respect because there was nobody at the other end of the pipeline who was carrying out their threats. When I hauled 54 juveniles into juvenile court for truancy and brought in their families, all of a sudden the truancy problem throughout the island plummeted. No social policy change, just some enforcement. We only had to prosecute one of those. Just bringing them into court on charges suddenly change the entire atmosphere. So sometimes that kind of shove in the right direction will make a difference. Now, I'm pontificating too much. I think Representative Simmons is up.
Good
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not quite as uncomfortable as some of my colleagues are. I would be more comfortable with reducing the safety zone to 1,000 feet, but I need some clarification here. Sub B, it talks about a school employer law enforcement officer has notified the person that the person's conduct is causing inconvenience, annoyance, and so on and so forth. Is that intended to be verbal or in writing, or what kind of notice do you envision?
That's right. That question should be directed to me, Representative Maddox. Verbal. That was to deal with the situation that the Georgia statute has not dealt with, where they don't even have to notify. You simply are in the zone, and you're in trouble. Here we said you had to be notified, officially notified, and verbal. It didn't have to be written. It could be verbal, either one. But it's intended to be either verbal or written.
Current practice on trespass notice, which would be the same parallel, is that we, in fact, do those in written form. And one of the issues has been, one of the things that has been difficult is that if you've got someone trespassing and they refuse to give you the correct name, or you have no way of verifying that, and without the ability to arrest them and check it, we've got to take their word for it. But we do issue written trespass notices now for people on our property. So it seems as though that could, in an implementation phase, maybe be a part of that. And that could be a point at which due process issues could be addressed. There could be a due process loop at that moment, which would take care of the concerns of Representative Prinsky.
Representative Sinceri.
I just, for the concern, I just checked with our counsel on this. There doesn't seem to be a legal definition of causing public inconvenience or an annoyance. So I'm wondering what kind of judgment the law enforcement officer would have here to determine that this person's committed a crime. I mean, he may be within 1,000 feet, but if we don't know what a public inconvenience is, or a risk of public inconvenience, or a risk of annoyance, then we don't have any definitions, or we're not creating something here that that a law enforcement officer or a school employee, can actually work with.
Well, Mr. Chair, that language, a person commits the crime of disorderly conduct if with the intent to cause public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm, or reckless creating a risk thereof, that language already exists in law, Representative Sinceri, up above. So what I'm saying is we simply repeated it again down here. So maybe your question is still a very good one. I'm not trying to say it isn't, but I'm saying that's where that language came from, and that's why legislative counsel put you're trying to track as closely to existing language as possible. So that's why the language was used.
All right, here's where we are. First of all, gentlemen, I appreciate you both coming in, Mr. Davalos and Mr. Kalb, and also Mr. Campbell. I appreciate your assisting here. The committee's had its questions answered. There's no doubt that there's a problem here. We will endeavor to find a solution that's workable. Some other solutions are also in the works out there. That's why I mentioned these other changes in some other laws that I think will help with enforcement. It may be that the solution for us is to draft some outline of legislation that would allow school districts and cities to work together to implement their own exclusion zones as school safety zones. That way there's a model that every school district could adopt by resolution, and so could the city council, and then you could have an enforcement program. I will ask our council to take a look at the Portland ordinance to see if we could come up with such a model in the statute as one solution. In the meantime, Senator Courtney, you're welcome to check with committee members to see what the sense of the committee is as to the necessary constitutional majority to issue a bill to the floor. As you know, I'm very sympathetic to this problem, and I just want to make sure we can come up with a solution. I thank you all for your time this morning, and this concludes the work session on Senate Bill 844.
Mr. Chair, before the school personnel leave, I just want to take away the fear that you created by suggesting that maybe they want to take some of their school budget and pay to have a district attorney. I think if these gentlemen were given an opportunity to respond, they would tell you that they can't afford that.
Well, it depends on how much more money we give to the schools this session.
I don't think it's going to be anywhere near enough.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We were on Senate Bill 944. We'll move back into, from the recessed hearing on 944, back into 944. I'd ask if Gina McClard did arrive or if traffic kept her. Oh, she is here. Please come up. Is David Neville still here? I'll ask, invite you back up, and Mr. Rice, you're welcome back up too. And what we're going to do is work this for about 10 minutes. We have session at what, 10 o'clock? We also have Senate Bill 975 up. I understand there's going to be a need for some amendments from the Justice Department on Senate Bill 975. So at least that was a heads up I have for Mr. DeLashwood. That being the case, I'm under a little less pressure to try to move that out today. I'd love to see those amendments quickly so we can keep that moving. We will convene the hearing, though, and get some testimony in so we can get rolling. Hi, welcome.
Hi, Chair Mannix, members of the committee. I'm Gina McClard, the staff attorney for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I have submitted my written testimony as well as written testimony from a survivor of sexual assault in Coos County, but for sake of time, I'm going to forego any testimony specifically on Senate Bill 944 because we understand that you have questions. But I'd like to defer to Dale Penn to, ask, to answer the specific questions you had about lack of verbal or physical resistance. And I just wanted to add that I have spoken to several survivors of sexual assault from all over Oregon, specifically some from Eastern Oregon and from Eastern Multnomah County that wanted to be here today, but because of travel times early in the morning, they couldn't make it. So I just wanted to add that there are people here who are very, very interested in your support of 944. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorneys Association. We strongly support Senate Bill 944. It was a little shocking to discover that Oregon is way behind in its statutory treatment of sexual assault. And we were one of only four states that, continued to require that sexual assault victims must fight their attacker. And that was the reason for 944. It was simply clarified Oregon law to bring it in compliance with what every other state except three or four have already done. Our statute was drafted based upon the New York statute and Michigan statute, and these changes in 944 are basically the changes that New York and Michigan have already long ago done. I'll address the one issue, I guess, that's come up, and I apologize for being late this morning, but on page 2 of the bill, at line 5, there is a statement that a lack of verbal or physical resistance does not constitute consent. I want to make it real clear that in any consensual sexual assault offense, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was not consent for this to be a crime. This statement doesn't change that burden of proof whatsoever. This simply says that if a victim has not verbally or physically resisted, that by itself does not mean that there was consent. Okay? The state is still going to have to prove there was not consent to the sexual act, and we still have that burden. The defendant does not have a burden on that issue. I guess the main point that we would try to bring forward on this is that victims in sexual assaults, more than any other crime, are attacked and blamed for the crime. And these changes by the law clarify that victims are not going to be blamed. It changes nothing about the burden of proof and the requirement of the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the elements. But that's what 944 does. That's why we think it's good law. That's why the Senate has referred it to you for your consideration. Be happy to answer any questions.
Chair. What position is this going to put people in terms of false accusations?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sinceri, from my analysis, it's not going to change the framework at all, except that in the midst of an actual sexual assault trial, the victim blaming that goes on right now will be restricted. So this issue of whether or not a victim physically fought her attacker, which we tell all victims in armed robberies and every crime except sexual assault, we tell victims, don't physically resist because you'll be killed if you do.
Many do. So that clarifies that issue. It clarifies the issue that victims will not be attacked by the clothes that they wear, and which typically happens. And then here, it just simply clarifies for the jury. The jury will still have to consider all of the evidence and make a decision if they believe that this was non-consensual and they believe it beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the only way that they would be able to vote for a conviction. This just clarifies, simply because a victim, through fear or for whatever reason, does not actively communicate this resistance or verbally or physically resist, that does not necessarily mean that she consented. That's all that means. We still have to prove lack of consent for a conviction. So I don't believe that changes anything in the dynamics, except that this statute prevents victim attacks in the midst of a sexual assault trial.
Mr. Rice, your shot.
Chairman Mannix, members of the committee, it is technically true that the defendant in a case like this doesn't have to prove anything, but practically that is not true. If a person is accused of engaging in a sexual assault and they choose to remain silent and not say something, I think the chances of that person being convicted would be very good. There is a reality that takes place in the courtroom, and while jurors listen to the law that's read to them at the end of the case, during the case it's suspect. There's a suspicion on the defendant, and the defendant needs to pragmatically rebut that. And my earlier comments directed toward, not toward fighting people off, but just the verbal aspect of this, of saying, no, stop, I don't consent to this. I think that aspect needs to be addressed. I don't think it has adequately been addressed. I think that part of this particular statute should be deleted.
Rebuttal?
Chair Mannix, first of all, I would like to point out that over on the Senate side, after we had the public hearing, we had a work group at which Dale Penn, myself, and Ingrid Swenson got together to discuss some problems with the bill. And at no point did she point out that this particular aspect of the bill, the lack of verbal or physical resistance, was a problem that she highlighted to us. We did not work on that portion of the bill, and it was not discussed at that point. Secondly, I do want to point out that although I did come in late, and I apologize for that, I believe that Mr. Rice brought up an incident at the University of Oregon, and I just wanted to make a distinction between Oregon law and the code of conduct at the University of Oregon, that their code is much more progressive, and that's the term I would use, in that it requires the defendant to prove that the victim said, consented to sex, as opposed to the fact that she, in fact, did not consent. So there's a distinction there. And I also want to point out...
Yeah, let's stay away from the student code as the University of Oregon.
I want to clarify something, sure. Because I believe this is a case I was actually a student conduct hearings officer on, and it was under the old code that the person set in the incident I was privy to, and then there's another incident if it's the same one. And so there are two different things. So
let's stay away from that because it has its own complications. Go ahead, though, and then we're
sure. And just I wanted to point out that had a survivor from Medford been able to be with us today, she would have testified to the fact that this law has provided much anguish for her beyond the sexual assault she experienced. She was in her apartment, sleeping with her two small children in the room right next to her, and her rapist broke into her apartment and sexually assaulted her, but she did not speak out, she did not cry out, because she was afraid that had she, her two small children would have run into the room and their lives would have been at risk as well. So this is a practical change to our laws that has had some devastating effects, because in that case there was no possibility for prosecution because she didn't earnestly resist her attacker. Thank you.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little surprised, too, that Oregon law is so far behind the national curve
But I also still have a problem with section, the number two under section two. You said that this was not brought up as an issue during the work group. My question, however, is it's an issue now. So is it something that you're willing to work on? Because, I mean, I feel that though this committee is extremely supportive of this bill, the case that you talked about is one extreme, but then you've got the other extreme that I know people have some concerns about, which is it's rape considering the age of the individuals, and then there's, you know, there are other areas that this could be used to destroy someone's credibility before they've had their day in court, and whether to prove that they've committed a crime. So because this is an issue, and this, you know, more than one person has brought this up, I'd like to know if you and Dale Penn and others are willing to work on this particular section or eliminate it.
Chair Mannix, Representative Bowman, we certainly are willing to work on any aspects of this bill that you have a problem with, specifically this Section 2, Subsection 2. I'd like to defer to Dale to speak to the specific problems with the verbal language and...
Well, let's be clear here. First of all, we're not bound by whatever any Senate work group does, but we always respect the process and we respect the fact that work groups often come to solutions that we can then adopt. No problem. We can also refuse them. No problem. We can modify them. No problem. It's really up to this committee and the majority of this committee or all of this committee to make a decision. As I'm understanding the issue, though, the issue is now focusing on one line, which is page 2, line 5. I don't hear any argument about the rest of this bill. I may be assuming too much, but I think I can assume the rest of it's okay. Let's be careful about what this really says. This is in the consent part of the statute. Now, already, the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the victim did not consent. They're in there. They do their case. The defense can still come back and say, wait a minute, yes, she did consent, and it's usually he, she in this situation, but not always. And we're simply saying in statute, a lack of verbal or physical resistance does not constitute consent. We're not saying that verbal or physical resistance constitutes refusal. We're not saying that, we're just simply saying the non-existence of something doesn't prove anything. And the problem is right now that the, if I may use the term, sharp criminal defense lawyer will create the implication that any woman would say no, therefore, because she didn't say no, she implicitly consented. And you're pointing out there are cases where a woman will not say anything because of threats and intimidation and fear. You say one word and you're dead. Therefore, you say nothing, therefore you consented. Give me a break. Is that your position?
Mr. Chair, that's it exactly. That's why I believe line 5 is a correct statement of the law, and it simply takes away the attack on the victim. We still have to come forward and convince you beyond a reasonable doubt as a trier of fact that this person did not consent. She is going to be exposed to cross-examination. She's going to be asked that question over and over again. Did you say no? Why didn't you say no? What actions did you take to communicate that there was no consent? All of that's going to happen in the trial.
But then in closing argument, when the defense attorney tries to say, she said nothing, therefore he had a right to believe she consented, the prosecutor can say, objection, that's contrary to the law. Saying nothing does not constitute consent.
It doesn't prove anything.
Well, but Mr. Chair, I'm having a hard time with that. I mean, if somebody comes in your window and assaults you in your bed while you're asleep, I can't imagine anybody saying that that was consensual. Oh, I was expecting this guy to come in my window, and I was expecting to have sexual relations with him when he got there.
Maybe the person who climbed in knew the victim.
Well, I mean, but that's irrelevant. I mean, if somebody breaks into your house and attacks you, then, I mean, I see differently. I don't see it as simply as you and Mr. Penn see that
Chair,
statement.
I can't even fathom that a jury would consider if you stuck a gun in a woman's face and said, you say a word and I'm going to kill you, and so she doesn't, and the jury's going to say, well, that means that she was not refusing. I mean, a jury would surely consider that. I just want to say, so you have a sense of the committee, I'm not going to support this bill with this language in here.
personally, okay? I just, I think that there's too much of a, I have supported women and I've supported sex offender legislation to the hilt, but I see gaping hole here. And we have enormous penalties for people who are convicted of these things, and to create a situation where a woman can just be passive and then charge somebody after the fact with something, and this would lend itself to that as I read it. I just can't see supporting something. The rest of the bill is fine.
Let's move. Counsel, what did you have to point out to us?
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman, a couple of things. The first thing would be that just for the record that the threat that Representative Cesari you talked about, of course, would be covered on page 1, lines 10 through 12 under existing law in terms of a gun pointing to somebody's face, a threat expressed or implied. Really, I think the other point that I haven't heard from the witnesses, but I'm assuming, is that one of the real major purposes of page 2, line 5, the line that's really in contention here, is as a jury instruction. Am I right? And that what is really going to happen is that the jury is going to come back after some time of deliberation to a judge and say, well, we're a little bit confused on the law. What happened here? We're trying to decide if there was consent or not. And there wasn't really any verbal or physical resistance or not much, and what does that mean? And with this line, then the judge would be able to, and I don't think the judge necessarily could right now, instruct a jury that, well, that by itself, of the lack of verbal or physical resistance by itself, members of the jury, does not constitute consent. And the reason I'm bringing this up is it seems to me that that is really why this line is in here, is a jury instruction, right?
That's correct. And
okay.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Horton, that's exactly why it's here, and it's just to clarify that proof of nothing proves nothing. That's all this line says.
All right. I think we have the issue in front of us, and the question then will be for Representative Brzezinski.
Just a little history regarding this insertion. Can we get some history as to what other states, I mean, is this the exact language that's being used? Are we modeling this after what other states have done?
Chair Mannix, Representative Brzezinski, this language is taken from the Illinois law on sexual assault, and it came about as a result of what we were hearing from advocates all over the state, particularly advocates in Lane County. That
wait a minute. He wants to know about other states. You've mentioned Illinois. Could you mention some other models? Not what came about in Oregon, if I understood the question, but what other states are doing if we're modeling ourselves after that?
Chair Mannix, I'm sorry. I don't know how many other states have this exact language.
Could you just see, I mean, I'd like to just know, if we're going to catch up with the trend, then that means there's more than one or two states that are doing this. They've had it on the books for some time. It may give more comfort for some people. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brzezinski, if I could add, I've seen a memo that Ms. McClard did in the Senate side just talking about consent language. We have not offered a definition of consent. And a variety of states have gone way beyond describing what consent is, and we haven't gone that far at all. But this is a concept that is in many of the states, just saying if there is no conduct, that doesn't prove anything. The state still has to prove lack of consent, but this is a very neutral kind of statement compared to what other states have done on the issue of consent.
All right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask, we're going to set this for work session on Thursday, May 27th. I'm going to ask to have one amendment made, two amendments made, which provide us with the option. One is to say simply a lack of physical resistance does not constitute consent. Another is to say a lack of verbal or physical resistance by itself does not constitute consent. Another would say a lack of verbal or physical resistance by itself does not constitute consent, but may be considered in the context of all the other facts of the case, something like that. Those options will all be in front of us. Proponents and opponents of those options can discuss them with the committee members. We'll go into work session with those amendments available and see what the sense of the committee is.
Mr. Chair, would you also ask for an amendment that just deletes line 5?
All right, that option also. Representative Brzezinski.
Since you have a couple of days before we come back, it may be something based on what the chair has suggested, see if there's some mutual agreement that can be reached, if possible, on those suggestions.
And our options are, A, adopt the bill as is. Personally, I'm just fine with it, okay? And you can so don't bother asking me. But I'm fine with it with modifications if necessary to get the votes. B, we're going to do a lack of physical resistance alone. C, we're going to do a lack of verbal or physical resistance by itself. D, we're going to delete the entire line. E, we're going to say a lack of verbal or physical assistance by itself does not constitute consent, but may be considered in the context of all of the facts of the case or some such phraseology. Those will be the options in front of us, and what you need to do is probably work your way down the list as to where the necessary four votes can be found as to that version. And we'll conclude the hearing on Senate Bill 944, and I thank you. We'll move on to Senate Bill...
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes.
Would you mind going back to House Bill? Could we suspend the rules and go back to House Bill 2238 to give Representative Pazansky and Hansen an opportunity to vote on that bill?
I'm sorry, but I'm not willing to agree to that. You can always move to suspend the rules to allow that.
Isn't that what I asked?
I thought you asked if I would agree and you could have unanimous consent.
No, to suspend the rules so that we could go back.
Representative Bowman moves to suspend the rules to return to work session on House Bill 2238 to allow, Representative Pazansky and Representative Simmons to vote, excuse me, Representative Hansen to vote on the measure. I'm opposed to doing it for that particular bill, but the motion's properly in front of us. So the motion is to suspend the rules, and we'll call the roll on the motion.
Representative Bowman?
Yes.
Representative Gianella?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Simmons?
No.
Representative Sunseri?
No.
Vice Chair Pazansky?
I guess I'd say yes to conflict, but yes.
No, the motion is defeated. All right, we're going into public hearing on Senate Bill 975, and I understand, Mr. Glassman, give us a quick heads up about what's happening here, and we can go on with it.
Yeah, actually, the bill came out of the Senate with no opposition in committee or on the floor, and subsequent to that, the Attorney General's office contacted me, was concerned about the way it actually technically was written. In actually Section 1, Sub 1, there may be some concern there that information could not be released even to, let's say, another law enforcement agency if an undercover cop in driving his own vehicle had sped. So they wanted to make sure that they took care of the way it was actually technically drafted. So that's one of the concerns that they're redrafting. Another concern, if you look at the bill...
All right, let me ask, is there going to be agreement as to these amendments when it's brought back to us?
It's my understanding, yeah, we're working toward agreement. There is one additional point, though, that we're still working on that's not between the proponents of the bill and the Attorney General's office that we're working on, too, and it's on the final page. I just alerted to this. It's line 12, information about a personal investigation that does not result in discipline of the employee. We understand what we're trying to get at. The City of Portland, however, approached me and said, if in fact the case was an unsubstantiated complaint, could in fact then you release the fact that it was an unsubstantiated complaint? So we may be doing a little drafting around that, too.
What I'd like to try to do real hard is see if those drafting issues can be addressed by Thursday.
Give it our level best.
This is Senator Corcoran's bill. I want to be helpful to him on this and certainly helpful to the proponents. The reason I'm doing this quickly is I understand there was not a great deal of opposition to the concept, and we just want to make sure it's done nice and tight. If there is a problem, in other words, I'll always hold a 10-hour public hearing if need be to hear all concern, but if everyone's in favor of something and just need to work out the language, we can hear from people about that. But we're getting on a pretty short fuse, so please try to have those amendments ready for Thursday. Then make sure the committee members are aware of the issues in the bill. We may be able to do a quick hearing and work session on it and move it accordingly.
Thank you for the instructions, Mr. Chair.
And is there anyone else that can't be here Thursday that wanted to be heard on 975? All right, there's no other witnesses. That will conclude the brief public hearing on Senate Bill 975. Another heads up for our committee, I was advised late yesterday that it's desirable that we close down as of close of our business on Friday. However, we will be called back in to finish work on some bills at the call of the chair. So it's not a total close down, but we will not be holding routine hearings and work sessions at our routine time anymore. You'll find we're in a pretty tight schedule. And So we'll just keep moving at this pace for the next few days. But Friday, I understand session's going to start at 9. If that's the case and we have bills to do, we'll start at 8 and do what we can in that 1 hour. And then, again, we have some things pending, and I will work with the leadership. They understand that to have, when we have amendments ready on several bills, we'll arrange a time for us to come back in and work them. But we are into the draining of the pipeline situation now.
Good. I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I thought suspending the rules was just a procedural move. I've never...
Well, all right, I'll explain to you. I'll be very open. Quite deliberately, I thought if we had a couple of no votes, then I'd be facing a minority report, and I didn't want to do that. So that's why I didn't want to suspend the rules.
I think it's, you know, ridiculous. We sit here, we work all session, and then you're concerned about a minority report. You run a bill through within 4 minutes from the start time. No notice is too late. What you're going to do, you went over the schedule, the timing of when these different bills are supposed to be heard.
We're moving very quickly now.
Well, you're also taking them out of order from the way they were set on the calendar.
We've been doing that all session. We're adjourned.